morning. We'll call to order Senate State Affairs. It's about 1:02 by my time. Sorry we're late. With us today we have Senator Giesel, Senator Wilkowski, and myself, Chair Dyson. Senator Coghill will be here shortly. He's on a radio program with a bunch of students from Fairbanks, and we'll get here as soon as he can. It's my intention for us to dispose of all the issues on our calendar today. Please turn off your cell phones, particularly the ones with obnoxious ringers on them. And I have no idea what Senator Stedman's about. All right. First thing we're going to do is take up the confirmations. Let's see. First step. The Commissioner of Department of Public Safety, Gary Folger. Would you join us? Identify yourself for the record. We have your pretty impressive resume. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gary Folger.
And give us a little brief recitation of the highlights of your resume.
I have a prepared statement.
All right, please. Okay.
I am the commissioner designee for the Department of Public Safety. I am
Hold the mic a little closer to you. Turn up the volume a little, please. Your volume.
Okay. I am both humbled and honored to come before you today for this your consideration. Let me start by saying this is one of the most difficult things for me to do, trying to sell oneself. It goes against everything I was brought up believing, never to talk about oneself. Even while out hunting, it was a taboo to point at an animal or say something like, I was going after that one. I grew up in Cantwell. I was brought up in two worlds, so to speak, a traditional Alaska Native home and the Western culture. Not once did I ever feel trapped in either world. To transition between the two was easy for me. Once as a small boy, I saw an Alaska State Trooper get off the train in Cantwell. In those days, it was the highlight of the day to meet the train. The trooper got off the passenger train, shook a few hands, and then got back on. I asked my grandmother who he was. She simply stated he was the muscle. I've often wondered where would my grandmother get something like that. She was born at the turn of the century at the upper end of the Susitna River. So I've often thought about that. It wouldn't be but a few more years when the Parks Highway was put in that I next saw another trooper. That particular trooper and I are, who's now retired, and I are to this day friends. I became more interested in law enforcement throughout high school. And then it happened. I got a speeding ticket. I thought it was much better to give than to receive, being the nice fellow that I am. In 1979, I started out in this department as a summer helper. In 1981, I went through the Trooper Academy and was stationed in Fairbanks. In 1991, I transferred to King Salmon after learning how to fly airplanes. In 1998, I transferred to Juneau as a Southeast Commander. In 2001, I transferred to Fairbanks as a Northern Region Commander. In 2007, I had the honor of becoming the Director of the Alaska Wildlife Troopers. This honor included starting back up the division after the merger was undone. In May of 2013, after 32 years, I retired. I was really enjoying retirement when Governor Parnell called and asked if I would come back as commissioner. I consider this the highest honor. Some have asked what kind of a leader I am. If I was to characterize it, I would have to say a situational leader. This department is steeped in a very proud tradition. I'd be autocratic in that I hold the rules, regulations, and laws. In the same token, I would be very open to change or a better way of doing business. My door is always open. I accept criticism well. I seek wisdom and understanding, and I'm never afraid to apologize. I'm also one of the first ones to stand up and do and take the right stand when it's time to do that. During the 1960s, NASA was underway with the Moon program. The media was doing a series of interviews with the NASA employees. One of these had a journalist talking to a NASA custodian. She stood behind her cleanup cart in a uniform, and when she was asked by the broadcaster, "What do you do at NASA?" her answer without hesitation on putting a man on the moon. Absolutely, bar none, the best part of this department are the employees. I have been witness to countless occasions when individuals go beyond the call of duty. It doesn't matter if it was the janitor, program planner, budget analysis, dispatcher, or trooper, I am honored to call them my friends and coworkers. If selected, where do I plan to lead this department? First, I would install a sense amongst our personnel that we work for the public. Earning and obtaining the public's trust is utmost in our goals. Public safety through public service. Second, whatever we do, do it well and to the best of our ability. And third, be a professional. When you go to the doctor, hairdresser, or restaurant, you hope they don't have a bad day. Why would we be anything less? Do we have challenges ahead? Absolutely. With declining revenue, we're going to have to make this organization even more efficient, but not lose our overall effectiveness. We have an ongoing mission of providing public safety combined with fiduciary responsibilities to our citizens. Rural law enforcement is another huge challenge. How do we provide services to even the smallest community? This problem is bigger than this department, but altogether, we can work towards this goal. Partnering with local, state, and federal programs, this can be accomplished for the overall betterment of our folks. This undertaking is something I'm going to focus on in my tenure. In closing, I want to offer you my services. After all, it's your department too. I have 32 years, which is almost all of my adult life. I don't even begin to know all the answers, but as a team, we can go forward. A few years back, I saw this quote at the end of a movie. It is attributed to Edmund Burke. The only necessary thing for evil to triumph is that good men do nothing. I am not going to let evil triumph. I plan on being the muscle that my grandmother spoke of.
Thank you. Questions for Gary? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary, great presentation. Thank you. You know, I have huge respect for our state troopers. And about 75% of the geographic area of my district, of my Senate district, is patrolled by state troopers. And I think they do a great job. But there are folks in my district that have had some bad experiences. And, of course, sometimes in the news, we hear about some bad apples, frankly. So how does someone who's the commissioner of public safety patrol, if you will, his own people, his own work, his own staff? How do you take this on?
My experience has been those bad apples, if we try to weed them out as best you can. You know, some of them you can just talk to, and then some of them you have to take progressive discipline up to and including termination. And then to earn that respect back from the folks is to meet with them and, you know, and say you've taken the necessary actions.
Other questions? I don't believe I have a conflict of interest, but my wife was a teacher at the high school that Gary went to. In Cantwell, did you know a family named Nikolai?
Yes. Cousins.
Yeah, Stoney and I were pretty good friends.
Stoney's good. In fact, he's going to be back here this month.
Yeah. Is there any objection to forwarding Gary Folger's name forward for confirmation? All right. Seeing none. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And thanks for your service.
Thank you.
Next, we'll take up Irene Catalone.
Morning.
Irene, please identify yourself for the record and give us a statement about why you want to work on the APOC.
Yes, my name is Irene Catalone, and I live in Fairbanks. I was born in Fairbanks. I worked for the state for a number of years. Part of that work was providing training for local government specialists. I worked in a large number of communities here in Alaska, both with village, state, and borough officials providing training and technical assistance. I'm familiar with APOC, and I believe in public service, and this is the public service I'd like to provide for the state of Alaska.
Are you, Irene, this is Chair Dyson, are you familiar with the work and the standards and the mission of APOC?
Yes, I am. As a local government specialist, part of the training we provided for city council members, et cetera, was training in APOC.
All right, and thank you. We have here in Alaska, at least in theory and quite a bit in practice, so-called citizen legislators, which means that they have other means of employment and are not just dependent upon this job and this salary. And Alaska is such a small state that most people who have private sector jobs will indeed in that responsibility have contact with the state and its agencies and personnel, and that can produce some interesting and sometimes difficult situations. Would you comment, please, on how you see the ethics of those kind of situations?
Well, as far as ethics, you know, that's another area I'm very familiar with, having worked for the state for a number of years. There are always conflicts. There are always misinterpretations of the rules and regulations, and I think there always will be. As I see the responsibility I will have on this, since I, you know, it's a voluntary position, you know, you don't really get paid for it, would be to impartially take a look at whatever the implied break in the rules was for the person that was brought up before the commission, and apply those rules and regulations, as well as listening respectively to all of the reasons and circumstances why perhaps something as mundane as filing a financial report on time wasn't done, you know, because one of the things, you know, and I will mention this just in passing because it intrigued me, is the fact that a person has to file a financial report after they leave office. You know, I wasn't aware of that. Now I am.
Yeah.
So I believe I can be impartial and fair.
Yeah, thank you. Certainly, our state has pretty good disclosure laws for candidates, but it has often been discussed in the press and so on that a candidate for public office who receives campaign contributions from a special interest group is therefore tainted and can't exercise good judgment because of the investments that have been made in their efforts to be elected. I guess I don't have a specific question, but would you like to comment on that issue?
Yes, you see that all the time in the news, in the press, on television. In fact, you know, I know there are several ads to that effect on the media right now. All I can say is an Alaskan has to look at these things, every Alaskan, including myself, and evaluate themselves, this information for themselves, take a look or a reminder of what the regulations state a person can and cannot do, and evaluate the candidacy based on those points.
Yeah, thank you. Questions for Irene? Seeing none, is there objection to passing Irene's name forward for confirmation? Seeing none, we'll take a brief at ease. We'll pass forward. Thank you, and thank you for your willingness to serve and past service. We'll take a brief at ease, won't we? on the record, and I have been corrected and coached here on how I should be conducting this, and I appreciate that. Back on the confirmation of Mr. Folger for Commissioner of Department of Safety, in accordance with Article 3, Section 25 of the Alaska Constitution and Alaska Statute 39.05.080, the State Affairs Committee reviewed the following and recommended the appointment be forwarded for joint session for consideration, Commissioner of Public Safety Gary Folger. This does not reflect an intent of any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during further sessions. All right. And before we proceed with the acting on Irene's position or appointment to the Public Offices Commission, we are going to take up Lewis Knives or Neves' appointment to the Alaska Police Standards Council.
Good morning.
Good morning, Lewis. Forgive my awkwardness here in processing this. Please identify yourself and give us your statement on this office. And for the record, we've been joined by Senator Coghill. Go ahead, Lewis.
I apologize. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this committee for giving me this opportunity. My name is Luis Nieves. Nieves is Spanish for snow, so apparently I found myself in the right place, living in Alaska. I'm originally from Queens, New York. When I was 17 and a half, I convinced my mother to sign a waiver so I could join the military. I joined the United States Navy. I served for 4 years. Settled in San Diego for about 3 years and decided that I wanted to continue to serve my country and also cut my teeth in law enforcement, so I joined the U.S. Coast Guard. Being fluent in Spanish, I found myself exposed to a lot of awesome opportunities serving throughout the world. I've served in South America as an instructor and conducting law enforcement operations in Mexico, Panama, Ecuador, Colombia, throughout the Caribbean, and even the Middle East. An opportunity arose after the tragic events of 9/11, where I responded to the Valdez terminal to provide protection for that asset of belonging to Alaska. And during that time, I realized that this was the state to raise children and to start a new life, to finally settle down, being in a transient lifestyle in the military. In 2004, I was assigned to the Maritime Safety Security Team out of Anchorage. During that time, I had the honor and privilege of providing a maritime protection for the cruise ship industry as well as other maritime assets and resource interests for the state of Alaska. In 2006, I saw an opportunity to seize in terms of wearing the uniform of an Alaska State Trooper. I became an Alaska State Trooper and started my career in Palmer, where I served on patrol and then on the DUI enforcement team, which is now known as Bureau of Highway Patrol. I then had the opportunity of being an investigator for the Child Abuse Investigations Unit out of the Mattsu Valley, where I also served as the law enforcement liaison for the Mattsu Crime Stoppers program, which is a very successful crime prevention program throughout the Mattsu Valley. I then realized that there was another opportunity out in Kotzebue where I could cut my teeth as a real trooper, seeing rural Alaska. And when I got out there, I was able to become an oversight trooper for the village of Selawik, working daily with entities within the Tribal Council, Elders Council, and City Council. Several years working in Kotzebue, I was able to promote to the rank of sergeant, and I am currently the recruitment sergeant for the Department of Public Safety Recruitment and Backgrounds Unit. I believe that my experience both in international law enforcement and my experience as an Alaska State Trooper, and now with my experience as a recruiter, seeing what it takes to wear this uniform to be a law enforcement officer in the state of Alaska, witnessing thousands of applicants, many of them, approximately 60% of them from the lower 48, trying to wear this uniform and trying to become a law enforcement officer in Alaska, I see the importance of being a member of the Alaska Police Standards Council and contributing to the fact that we hold some of the highest standards in the nation. I've sadly witnessed what it looks like in some of the lower 48 law enforcement agencies, and I've seen them time and time again fail to qualify to wear our uniform because of the lower standards. And if you provide me this opportunity, my goal is to contribute to maintaining the highest standards in law enforcement on my seat on the council. And once again, thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, and as I understand it, Lewis, the seat that you will be taking is the one that is designated for an officer of public safety. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, thank you. Any questions for Lewis? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Nieves, you have a very impressive resume. I'm looking at your qualifications and awards, you know, the radio spot that you initiated. You were a forensic child interviewer and recognized for that work. It's just very impressive. I think you'll be a great addition to the Police Standards Council. Now, when the commissioner designee, Gary Folger, was just here being interviewed, I mentioned to him that 75% of my Senate district is patrolled by Alaska State Troopers, and I realize this, the Police Standards Council goes beyond just the state troopers, but while I think the state troopers do a great job, there is occasionally the bad penny, so to speak, the bad apple in the group, and my district is aware of those bad apples, so to speak. How does someone sitting on the Police Standards Council raise the standards or enforce the standards or create that atmosphere of high standards? How would you approach that?
Well, thank you, Senator. The biggest thing right now is I can speak, for instance, for the Department of Public Safety, that there is the Office of Professional Standards that actually investigates all allegations of wrongdoing by anyone in the uniform within the Department of Public Safety. Within the council, there's 13 members that bring many layers of experience and very professional opinions about what a professional in this uniform should look like. And I'm very happy to see so far in the few meetings that I've attended that everyone maintains that high standard, and there's zero tolerance for people that are going to abuse this type of power that the in terms of the badge itself, which the which reflects the community's zero tolerance for that sort of thing. So, I mean, the biggest thing is that we can never take the risk of lowering standards just to fill vacancies. And I believe that all 13 council members are on board, and they represent what the people in Alaska demand of their law enforcement. Did I answer your question?
Yes, I think so. Thank you.
Lewis, this is Dyson. As I understand it, you all don't go looking for problem conduct, but respond to complaints. Is that true?
That's correct.
All right. Thank you. When you were with the Coast Guard security team after 9/11, were you with the team that went to Whittier?
Yes, sir.
You guys were scary looking. Several local drug dealers headed for the bushes.
Guess that's a good thing, sir.
Yeah, that's for sure. An issue in the past with the Police Standards Council is a police officer will be off the reservation in terms of conduct. There will be that gets exposed, and it appears to me that at least in some cases the union representing that officer and that officer will in essence do a kind of a plea bargain with their employer wherein the officer is allowed to retire or resign the position, and then there's nothing on that officer's record. In my own experience, I know one young man, I knew his family, and he went from three different police positions, two of them as chiefs in small communities, and they had no access to the previous accusations of inappropriate conduct. And so you can see the issue. Would you comment on that, and what, if anything, should be done with those kind of hopefully rare circumstances?
Well, sir, I can say that the council has our executive director, Kelly Alzaharna, that is also charged with the investigations, initiating the investigations and bringing her findings before the council. If a department is not reporting the misconduct to APSC, it's very difficult for us to, as a council, to rule on something that we're not aware of. I believe that once these issues are brought to the council does everything it can to hold people accountable, especially if they're in violation of any of the standards for which someone is certified as a peace officer in the state of Alaska. Concerning the person's past records, I'm not prepared to answer that because I'm not educated enough on how those records are maintained.
Yeah, I think so. The Police Standards Council can only respond to an official report that's brought to you. You can't respond to a so-called whistleblower. Is that correct?
I don't know that that's true, sir. I believe however it is brought to the attention of Kelly Alzaharna, she's the one who then briefs the council and then is able to conduct investigations. So it's regardless of whether it's a whistleblowing or a formal complaint.
All right. I see Kelly's here. Would you like to come forward? Please, thanks for being here. And
yes, sir.
Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Kelly Alzaharna. I'm currently the executive director of the Alaska Police Standards Council. In answer to the original question, the Standards Council takes complaints or concerns from any medium. There are certain instances where the agencies themselves, police, corrections, probation, parole, are required to report to the council, and they're specifically identified in regulation. However, we take citizens' complaints. If we hear of misconduct, sometimes it comes out through the media before anybody else knows, and if we're notified of that. If it's misconduct that rises to the level of our authority to investigate, we can and do investigate.
Any questions for Kelly? Kelly, in a previous hearing this committee had before the session started, it came up where there had been an egregious offense by a public safety officer, and that person was immediately fired, and then there was a complaint that due process was not followed according to the contract. Would you comment on those kind of circumstances?
Yes.
I think that's outside of your purview, but
discipline, as far as the discipline that an employing agency institutes against an employee, is separate from what the council does. However, if the behavior is egregious enough that would cause an officer to no longer meet the standards to hold their certification, then the council can and does act independently. So we do have agencies who may have a certain level of behavior, and they handle it by a certain level of discipline. But if that behavior makes them fall below the standards, the council can investigate and take action against their certificate.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Any questions for Kelly? Thanks for your service.
Thank you.
any objection to forwarding Lewis's name? All right. Well, we have both of these names to deal with. That is Lewis and Irene. Irene for the Public Offices Commission and Lewis. And so in accordance with Alaska Statute 3905080, the State Affairs Committee has reviewed the following and recommend appointments be forwarded to joint session for consideration. Alaska Police Standards Council, Sergeant Lewis Naves, Anchorage, he was appointed 6-1-2013, and Alaska Public Offices Commission, Irene Catalone, Fairbanks, appointed March 1, 2014. And this did not reflect the intent of any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation individuals during any further sessions. All right. Take a brief at ease while we all sign this. On the record, we'll now take up Senate Bill 182, an act relating to the salary difference in collective bargaining agreements subject to Public Employment Relations Act that are based on a difference of cost of living outside of the state, cost of living within the state. We have distributed to you a letter from Bill Milks, Department of Law, specialize in labor law there, and I met with him. The letter, as I understand it, confirms what we had in the conversation, saying that there is no legal or constitutional issue with this committee or this session of the legislature dealing with this bill, nor does it, he says, contravene National Labor Relations Act. He says that, states that whenever this bill might become law, then the underlying statutes would change. But any negotiations that are completed before that date would be under current law and have no effect. And as I understand, the Maritime Union's negotiations are ongoing. The committee, those contracts expire sometime in June. It'd be very unlikely that this bill would be, let's see, what's the date of the when it would become law? Yeah, immediately. So if indeed this passes this session, which is problematic, but if it does, then it, unless the contract is negotiated before then, this law would be in place. After then, it wouldn't. Bill Milks, the Department of Law, is online. Can you hear us, Bill?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I can. Thank you, Senator. Chair Dyson.
And did I accurately state what you said in your letter states?
I believe so. Yes, Senator.
All right. Are there questions for Mr. Milks? Senator Wilkowski, do you have a question?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. If Section 1702 of the Inland Boatman's contract, for example, I believe that's the contract. No, I'm sorry, the Master's Mates and Pilots contract says that this is a COLD is a mandatory subject of collective bargaining, should not be changed, modified, adjusted, redetermined, or altered in any way by the state unilaterally, and no change shall be made without the consent and agreement of the union. And so I guess it does go to a timing issue, but you have the state of Alaska before us today arguing for a change, modification, adjustment. They don't have the consent of the union. It would seem to me that if the bill passes, you have the state seeking to circumvent the collective bargaining agreement. I know it's not National Labor Relations Act, but it's the Public Employee Relations Act, but that seems to me to be an unfair labor practice, particularly if it goes into effect before the end of the contract. Is there any, and I don't have your memo right in front of me, I've seen it, but is there any Supreme Court case law on that that you're aware of?
Through the chair, Senator, there's not Supreme Court case law that I'm directly aware of. I think the point we're making is that the agreement itself would continue for the term of its agreement. The section you mentioned there, certainly that section is subject to negotiation like all the terms of the contract. And it's subject to negotiation under the rules that apply, which are what the Public Employment Relations Act states right now. So we couldn't envision an unfair labor practice. I believe the bill in front of you states that it does not affect existing agreements, so that existing agreement would continue to be in effect.
Senator Wilkowski, to continue.
And if the bill goes, the bill has an immediate effective date. If it goes into effect before the end of the contract, the cost of living differential goes away statutorily. So would it be better to have this go into effect after the end of the collective bargaining agreement?
Through the chair, Senator, the second part of your question, I think, of course, is up to you all, but I think as far as changing the terms of this agreement, I don't think so, because Section 3 states that the change in the law does not affect agreements that were entered into prior to the effective date of the Act. And it looks like this agreement was entered into in 2011.
Mr. Chair, and not to beat a dead horse, and again, just looking at the collective bargaining agreement, for instance, of the Inland Boatmen's Union, it says this agreement includes a pay plan providing a cost of living differential between employees living in state and those living out of state in accordance with AS 2340210. We're abolishing AS 2340210 and changing it. And this bill, if it does go into effect before the end of the collective bargaining agreement, would be citing a statute that is no longer in existence. So I'll just leave it there at that, Mr. Chair. I do have some concerns, but I think the safer approach would be to have an effective date after the collective bargaining agreement expires, but I don't want to belabor the point.
Bill, this is Dyson. When the law refers to the state of Alaska, does that a term of art? Does that mean the executive branch, or does that include the judicial and legislative branches?
Mr. Chair, I think for the purpose of this bill, it would be the entities covered under the Public Employment Relations Act. So I think specifically if your question is about the state of the uncodified law of the state of Alaska, I think there is referring to the general law of the state of Alaska. But again, the bill that you have in front of you also states that it does not affect agreements that are already in place.
Yeah. And I appreciate that answer. I was really thinking of the classic separation of powers, and that a section of law like this couldn't be binding upon the legislature and prohibit the legislature from changing statute. Am I correct?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Yeah, yes, I certainly agree with that. I think you're the legislature sets the rules through its affirmative law. I agree.
All right. Any other further questions or discussion from the committee? Chair will entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill 182, version 28-LS1432/N, November, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Objection.
I object, Mr. Chair.
Care to speak to your objection?
Yeah, I think it's fundamentally inappropriate for the administration to come before this body during the middle of a collective bargaining agreement and support a change to what they agreed to. And they specifically agreed to a provision that says they would not seek to change, modify, adjust, or alter in any way this provision without the consent of the union. The union's not consenting. This bill potentially goes into effect before the expiration of this. So I guess procedurally I have that issue. And then secondly, I just fundamentally disagree with what we're trying to do here, which would result in a pay cut to Alaskan employees while keeping the pay the same for out-of-state employees. I just fundamentally disagree with that, Mr. Chair, and so respectfully, I have to object.
I appreciate that. Any other questions, comments? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't see it that way. What this allows is for the unions to negotiate the wage they have been receiving as they negotiate this next contract. There's nothing here that says we're forcing a pay cut. We're simply placing it in a negotiated arena. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And having been a mariner most of my life, I'm very appreciative of the skills, experience that are necessary. And it's very important for the passengers, and particularly on Marine Highway System, to be safe. And I expect the administration will negotiate a contract that not only keeps, but it recruits very qualified people. And I understand the demand on this continent for experienced mariners, and most landsmen have no idea how much of the world's commerce moves by sea. And so I at least recognize it and expect a responsible action from the administration treating these folks fairly. We call the roll, please.
Senator Giesel?
Yes.
Senator Coghill?
Yes.
Senator Stedman absent. Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, no.
Close call. Be still my heart.
Chair Dyson?
Oh, and Chair Dyson, yes.
One name.
Thank you. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the document. It could take up. Record, and I neglected to mention that we are served today by our committee aide, Joshua Banks, and who's doing a marvelous job, and Chris and Shane, who are helping us, and we appreciate you all. All right, we have before us Senate Bill 98. We've heard this before. Who's going to be presenting and answering questions? Please come forward and give us your name. Position.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm David Scott. I'm staff to Senator Olson, the sponsor of the bill.
All right. Do you have any statements you want to make?
Thank you. Very briefly, Mr. Chairman. The sponsor is unable. He's traveling. He's on his way, but he's unable to be here today. But he wanted to state on the record that he He objects to the characterization of BPSOs as a private police force. He wants it to be known that he doesn't, that such characterizations are, that just that he objects to them. They, BPSOs are public safety officers of the state. They're created in state law. They're paid for state funds. It's a unique partnership between the state and the regional nonprofits and also municipalities. And they work daily with state troopers. When they make arrests, they transfer them to state troopers. They're not a private prison. They are not a private police force. The sponsor also would like to note that, and it's been talked about in committee, but maybe not stated so straightforward, but that Alaska is a very unique place, and we all take a lot of pride in that, uniqueness. And the VPSO program is a unique Alaskan solution to a unique Alaskan issue. There's state troopers cannot travel to rural Alaska as state troopers in rural Idaho can, or rural Washington, or rural California. There's a difference between rural Alaska and the rest of rural America, and the difference is lack of roads. That's the biggest difference. And the sponsors very supportive of this program. They are on the first line of defense. They are the first responders in a place in Alaska where it's tough to have state troopers full time. And so, and with that, I'll save any other statements or to try to answer questions. But the sponsor really wanted that on the record.
Excuse me. Questions for Dave? All right. Senator Giesel.
Well, I just a comment, and I was thinking about this when we heard the bill before. Alaska is very unique. In fact, we have other unique programs like community health aides, like community dental aides, all because of our rural configuration. So these are analogous that the health aides, the dental aides are also professionals that meet high standards.
Yeah, thank you. Is there anyone in the room that wants to testify? Sir, please come forward.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Sergeant Chris Gifford. I'm with the Public Safety Employees Association. First of all, Senator Giesel, I'd like to, through the chair, I'd like to address what you just said with the health aides in rural Alaska. I would ask also if those, I believe those people are probably certified health aides. I'm not sure, but they have gone through.
Hold the mic closer to you, please.
I'm sorry, sir. I don't know, but I would bet that those are certified nurses and health aides through the training and education required to provide those services. I think that Senate Bill 98 can be approved upon. I think it essentially authorizes VPSOs to carry a firearm in the same manner as a police officer, and PSEA believes the VPSOs should be trained to the same standards that police officers and state troopers are. The purpose of the stringent training is to ensure that in a deadly force situation or a potential deadly force situation, the VPSO is capable to determine whether deadly force is in fact authorized and that no other option is available. Because in the end, that's our job as citizens and lawmakers to guide those responsible for protecting the public by making sure that those who do protect the public have the best training that they can get. PSEA's position on this is that VPSOs should receive full police training if they're going to carry firearms and be possibly using deadly force. Thank you very much.
Any questions? hang on a second. Jake Metcalf, can you hear us, Jake?
I'm here, Senator Dyson.
Greetings. Do you want to give us your testimony?
Thank you very much, Senator Dyson. Committee, thank you for allowing me to testify. If we could have a minute to establish my credentials. I'm the Executive Director for the Public Safety Employees Association, Local 803. I'm in Anchorage, Alaska right now. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. spent 7 years in rural Alaska as a assistant district attorney and district attorney in the Yukon-Kuskokwim region, which is one of the areas where probably the majority of VPSOs are employed. In my capacity as a prosecutor, I work closely with VPSOs, Alaska State Troopers. I want to talk a little bit about the VPSO program. I would refer you to a report, the Alaska Rural Justice and Law Enforcement Commission report of 2006. That report at page 11 has very good background information on the VPSO program. It was created in 1979 by then-Commissioner Bill Nix. And an employee of the Department of Public Safety by the name of James Messick. And in a proposal, one of the things they said is public safety in rural Alaska is perhaps the most neglected aspect of village life, and this poses a serious threat to bush residents inhabiting about 200 villages. It then goes on to list a number of statistics regarding public safety, and then it ends with a saying, it is safe to assume that no group of Caucasian communities would tolerate similar circumstances and that they would demand equal protection under the law. With that background, the program was created, and it's gone through several iterations since it was created, but now they have, VPSOs have five basic areas that they cover: law enforcement, firefighting, search and rescue, water safety, and emergency medical services. They are trained in all those aspects. Their training is different than your basic law enforcement training. They have different duties. They don't have the standards. They don't work under the same standards as law enforcement. And I just would refer to Board Member Gifford's testimony and Senator Giesel's testimony from earlier about standards. PSCA takes great pride in the members that it represents, and it is concerned about the standards and the training that its members get. Bad apples are unfortunately in every group that is in society, and standards and training provide the opportunity to make sure that you've got the best people working in positions of trust. And if the VPSOs are state employees, like the sponsors aide discussed, if they're going to put on a weapon and do law enforcement duties, they should work under the same training and same standards that other state and local law enforcement employees work under. We think that is extremely important if the state is going to recognize these employees as law enforcement officers. We think it's important to the community that they have equal protection under the law, just like everybody else in Alaska. So we urge, PSCA urges, that this committee include in the bill training so that VPSOs have the same training that other law enforcement officers in this state have. We think that protects the state. We think that protects the native nonprofits that employ the VPSOs, and we think that protects the VPSO themselves so that they're making the right decision, and it protects the village and the people within the village. So we urge you to make sure that they work under the same training and same standards, and that you provide enough money so that the VPSOs can get the training they need if you do pass this bill. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Are there questions for Jake? All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Dyson.
Further questions or discussion from committee members? All right. Seeing none, what's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Senator.
I do have an amendment, which I distributed at the last meeting.
All right.
And I think you all have that.
We do. I believe it.
go ahead.
Call my staff up just in case there are technical questions. But I'd like to offer amendment number one.
I'll object for discussion.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, what it's a simple amendment. What this does is it would require that VPSOs who carry firearms meet the minimum standards that are consistent with the standards adopted for police officers. And it's, I think, fundamentally the Native Village officers should have the same training as those in urban Alaska. So if there's technical questions, my staff can answer.
Questions from the committee? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, the North Slope Borough employs their own village safety officers now who are armed. So my question to the committee aide is, how many issues, problems, have there been experienced by the North Slope Borough who currently arm their VPSOs?
For the record, my name is Monica Southworth, aide to Senator Wilikowski, and with regards to that question through the chair, Senator Giesel, I'm here more to answer technical questions about the amendment, not so much substantive, and I apologize for that.
Further questions? Comments from the committee on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Giesel.
Thank you. The amendment indicates, and the sponsor of the amendment has indicated, that unless this more defining amendment is adopted, that these folks will not be competent to carry firearms. And my point in asking the question about the North Slope Borough is, there haven't been incidents. That it's worked very well. I will hearken back to my comment about the certified health aides. Those are hired, again, by the communities. They are not state-licensed individuals. The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium hires them and sets their standards. So I think that there has been demonstrated competency in hiring professionals by the Native corporations. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
Maybe I could ask the question. So the original language is meet minimum standards training for carrying firearms, and this says minimum standards consistent with standards adopted by the Police Standards Council. Maybe both you and the sponsor of the bill could give me what the difference may be between minimum standards generally and the standards by the Police Standard Council, but probably for the maker of the amendment. At this point, is there a difference that you have seen, and is there something that we should entertain on that?
Please.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill. The amendment before you directly addresses some of the concerns that were brought up by both Sergeant Gifford and by Mr. Metcalf, just with regards to having extensive training, which is more than the bill currently requires.
Mr. Chair, if I could, if you look at, we specifically reference AS 1865-240, which is the standards for training, and there, it outlines what the training should be in that statute, and that's all we're saying, is that the training should be the same as police officers under AS 1865-240. I can read it if you like. It says, the person may not be appointed as a police officer except on a probationary basis unless the person, one, has satisfactorily completed a basic program of police training approved by the council, which includes at least 12 hours of instruction regarding domestic violence as defined in AS 1866-990, and two, possesses other qualifications the council has established for the employment of police officer, including minimum age, education, physical and mental standards, citizenship, moral character, and experience. The council shall prescribe the means of presenting evidence of fulfillment of these requirements. So the difference is the statute, the way it's currently written, my understanding is it just says has minimum standards, doesn't define what those are. this would define what those minimum standards are. And I guess just to address Senator Diesel's point, my understanding is that the North Slope Borough are not VPSOs. Those are police officers. So that's they would be required to meet the standards under this.
So, Mr. Chairman, maybe if I could get the sponsor of the bill to respond to that.
Please identify yourself again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, David Scott, staff to Senator Olson. And I think I'm answering Senator Coghill's question. Senator Coghill, and for the record, the sponsor objects to the amendment. We've had assurances from the Department of Public Safety that VPSOs, that those who apply to carry firearms will receive the identical arms training as state troopers and municipal police receive at the very with the very same instructors at the very same training facility. Their training that they will receive for firearms, again, will be identical to what troopers receive and what the municipal police officers receive. They will also receive identical psychological evaluations. The DPS has said this on the record, and that they will receive the identical psychological evaluations that state troopers and municipal police receive. The arming of VPSOs is going to happen, Mr. Chairman. They are we have been told it may happen as soon as May 1st when the regs are done. The DPS is doing the regs. They're changing the regs to allow VPSOs to be armed. It's already happening. I can stop there.
Senator Coghill?
Mr. Chairman, if we're going to do it precisely the same, I'm just curious what the difference between giving us that assurance and putting them under the Police Standards Council requirements are. Is there other issues on putting them under the requirements of the Police Standards Council that is a concern?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, you get down to brass tacks in this building, you start talking about money and funding, and the sponsor is very concerned that the fiscal note would get to a point where the increased costs would threaten the communities and the VPSOs who serve would be. Public safety can be put in jeopardy, is the sponsor's concern.
So, Mr. Chairman, what I'm hearing is that the state would have an additional cost. That goes certainly to the communities, and I would take it. And so, it sounds to me like the communities at this point have the ability to say yay or nay on arming. And so I guess they would be the ones accepting the cost. I kind of like the idea, personally, of making sure that they somehow are mandated to the same standard. I'm going to honor the wishes of the sponsor at this point, but that assurance at this point really comes down to who's paying the cost, I guess, then. All right.
Yeah. Do either of you have, just Dyson, have an idea what the fiscal impact of this amendment would be?
Mr. Chairman, I couldn't answer. We'd have to get the folks from DPS to answer that.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. My understanding is what I've been told is they thought it would be about $9,000 to train someone, and which I don't think is very much different than what this training cost is, but I could be wrong on that, Mr. Chair. I don't. That's a number that was told to me sort of off the cuff by someone.
All right. Further questions or discussion on the amendment? All right. I'll maintain my objection and call the roll, please.
Senator Stedman, absent. Senator Coghill?
No.
Senator Wilkowski?
Yes.
Senator Diesel?
No.
Chair Dyson?
No.
One yay, three nays.
All right. The amendment fails. We still have Mike Kuhn's online wishing to testify on the underlying bill. Mike, are you still there?
Yes. Senator Dyson, you hear me good?
Yeah. Choke up on the bat there. Get a little closer to the mic, would you please?
Yeah, I don't know what it is with this phone. I wanted to really just touch on one aspect, and I've been watching this. I've been following this thing through both the House and the Senate side. I've listened to Captain Arlo's presentations on the VPSO program overall, because this is something that I have been out to the villages. I've been to Hooper Bay. I've been to Allakaket. I've seen with my own eyes way the system works. I fully support arming the VPSOs. No question about it. No sweaty dog on that. The aspect that Keystone kind of was brought up last week was on liability insurance, and there was a big question on that. Liability insurance still doesn't stop wrongful firings. The liability insurance doesn't stop people doing stupid things. But my biggest concern on this whole thing is that I know that in the nonprofits are not law enforcement trained people. They're not thinking about law enforcement. They got a whole bunch of other issues on their mind. And I do know, and I've seen it firsthand, that there is a good old boy system throughout these nonprofits. And if somebody wants to file a complaint against that VPSO for doing their job, then there is no, I don't see, and I have not heard any thing from Captain Arlo or anybody that gives protection to these VPSOs that are now going to be armed, that are now going to have there's going to be somebody in some village, some place that's going to get upset because he's swaggering too much, or he's got his hand on, he put his hand on his pistol, much less when that really comes down to it, where that officer has to draw his weapon, and much less draw his weapon and fire. So I want to know is, where is the protection going to be? Where is that going to be coming down from? Is DPS going to go to bat for these guys? I know there's going to be investigations on any shooting. That's a given. But beyond the shooting, is DPS going to back these guys up, and is there going to be a methodology where that the nonprofits are going to have some standard? You know, if they're going to fire somebody, it's got to be for really good cause, and not just politics or somebody because somebody didn't like it, or because my cousin doesn't like this, and I'm on this, and I want to put the shaft to this guy because I don't like the part of his hair. You know, that is the big concern I've seen, and it's the only thing about this whole bill that I haven't heard a good answer to.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I appreciate it, and I think that's an informed concern. Is anyone here, public safety, that would like to speak to this?
Well, Senator Dyson, one last thing. There was nothing, I've asked about this as well. What about second chance vests for these DPSOs? If they're going to be carrying arms, if they don't have the second chance vests now, they sure need them.
On the record. Yeah, Mike, we do have quite a bit of information here about the questions you raise in the fiscal note. If you can't find that online, call my office and I'll get it to you. Any comments from the bill sponsor on the issues that Mike raises?
Mr. Chairman, it's been, this is David Scott for the record. That issue has been raised and it's been addressed by Colonel Cockrell several times. I believe he's also online, if he would like to.
Are you online, Mr. Cockrell? He's not online. Any further? Well, in essence, what was said?
Mr. Chairman, again, this is David Scott for the record. The DPS has stated that if there's ever an incident, that will be investigated fully. They've also stated on the record that part of the fiscal note is liability insurance. And that liability insurance goes towards to the regional nonprofits that are administering this or the one municipality that's also administering this.
And I would note that both he and the commissioner-elect have talked quite a bit in favor of the program and their very active supervision and training and cooperation with the village public safety officers. And there are going to be some inadequate performances. It's just human nature. It has been, this issue has come up for the last 6 or 7 years that I recently, lots of discussion, and I have seen the public safety troopers' opinion shift from significant resistance to now at least passive or assent to where we're going with all of this, and I appreciate that. Any other questions or comments from the committee? I raised the question here the last hearing we had on this. What do we do with a public safety officer who has to go deal with a nuisance bear in the dump? And clearly the response was we expect him to take his shotgun and do whatever necessary to scare the bear away and keep him away and almost undoubtedly shoot the bear if there's no other option. So there is a case of the we're all comfortable with a public safety officer carrying a shotgun, which can be very lethal, to deal with a bear, but the cognitive dissonance I have is to expect a village public safety officer to go into other dangerous situations, perhaps even less predictable than a bear, and be on the record that there's one person in this whole village that is not going to be armed, and that's difficult. I have enough experience to know with firearms, and my chief of staff wills this to me, a police officer, 25 years experience. Once you pull your gun, life changes. And even for a public safety officer to pull their weapon with the either actually or with the expectation he's going to point it at another homo sapien, significant things change. And then, of course, if there's ever a discharge or somebody wounded or killed, huge investigations and stuff follow all that. Difficult situations, but given so many communities that are very small and our inability to cover them with troopers or doctors or expert teachers or whatever, you know, we've got to make some of these adjustments to deal with the real situation. Our troopers, in my opinion, have nearly as good a reputation as the Mounties do in Canada. And the Mounties have a very similar responsibility. They cover vast areas of territory where there may be no loss law enforcement ever, or a community constable. And it is a symbiotic relationship, not unlike what we expect with our troopers in rural areas. And I've watched this debate over this the last 6 or 7 years, and I personally think we've come to about as good a solution as we can at this time. Is there objection to this bill going forward? All right, we'll close public testimony. The chair will entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill 98, version 28, LS0754/A-alpha, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there objection? Seeing none, it passes from committee with individual recommendations. We'll take a brief at ease, and next we will have Senate Bill 141. back on the record, take up Senate Bill 141. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Very simple bill. We would provide for a waiver of car registration, vehicle registration fee for National Guard members. It's about $100 a year, and our Guard members get paid. Boy, it's a pittance. It's about $206 a weekend, or $212 a weekend for the weekend that they work per month, and then the week that they work, or the 2 weeks they work, it's my staff has the numbers, but it's a very small amount. I mean, the total amount they get is about $3,000 per year. If they're deployed, they get a little bit, they get more, but this is something that a few other states have done, and it's something that was brought to me by some members of the Guard, and I think Steve Burris is online who can talk to that, but that's what the bill does, Mr. Chair.
Care to add anything?
For the record, Monica Southworth, staff to Senator Wilkowski. I have a lot of background information about the Guard and other benefits that the state of Alaska provides compared to other states. There's also a research report in your binder, but mostly I think I'd like to give Mr. Burris the opportunity to speak to this bill. And he is the president of the Alaska National Guard Enlistment Association, and he should be online for comment.
Senator Coghill? Senator Giesel?
Thank you. I just had a clarifying question. I couldn't understand what was said. How many other states do this?
There are three other states that offer vehicle registration fees. That's Tennessee, New Mexico, and Hawaii. And Virginia gives National Guard members a 50% discount for their registration fee. As far as vehicle issues for National Guard members, we do offer a special license plate, and that's an additional $30. Most states, the average is between $5 and $25 for the special National Guard license plate for your vehicle.
Thank you.
I saw somewhere in the documentation that there's about 4,000 members of Alaska Guard. Did I read that correctly?
Correct.
And how many of them are full-time, roughly?
There are 3,000, according to a report, there are 3,773 National Guard members, and in the reserves there are 1,015. So 3,773 active.
So that means that their full-time job is in the as in active duty.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, and 1,000 who are weekend warriors, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Senator Giesel.
Pardon me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if they're working full-time in the National Guard, clearly they're making a higher wage than the quote-unquote weekend warrior. Do you have a wage?
The starting entry-level pay for the lowest rank starts at $1,531.50 a month.
Senator Giesel, to
continue. So the other 1,000 or so here clearly work other jobs.
Correct. And within their other jobs, they do make more money. Being in the National Guard is not for financial security. That's not why they do it. I spoke with in Alaska, we offer a lot of benefits to National Guard members. Some of them include free fishing and hunting licenses for both active and reserve members, educational benefits, job training, low-cost insurance, travel benefits, and base privileges. The Alaska National Guard Enlistment Association has worked over the years to increase the benefit that our Guard members receive to entice them to join. I spoke with a recruitment officer, and when I told him about the bill, he was overjoyed. He thought it was fantastic because each one of the small benefits and perks that the National Guard members are able to offer as incentives to join does help with recruitment. In the past 12 years since we've had forces deployed to both Iraq and Afghanistan, we've had over 2.6 million soldiers return. Obviously, that's not only in Alaska, but there are a significant number of people that are returning home. The recruitment officer said it helps. Every little bit helps. And also, the National Guard does not have the same amount of money to throw at advertising that you see for the other branches of the forces. Mostly, Guard members join from word of mouth, job fairs, visiting schools, speaking with their community members, and it's the small perks like free fishing and hunting licenses.
Senator Geisel, to continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Continuing on the fiscal note, $100, this is a biennial vehicle registration fee. Does that include the local tax that is paid to the local government?
In this bill, that it is not. That is the way that the bill is written. In the motor vehicle registration tax, I think there were less than between maybe 13 cities that do that, and we're not addressing that. That will not be changed.
Senator Geisel, to continue.
Thank you. And looking at the fiscal note, in out years, it says zero, but that can't possibly be true. I see at the bottom $200,000, or it looks like $200,000 every year, you're saying is the deficit.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and we have Amy Erickson online from DMV who wants to testify, and maybe I'll answer some of these questions. Amy, can you hear us?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Amy Erickson, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. DMV has no problem implementing this bill if enacted. We do anticipate, though, that there would be approximately 80 hours of programming time and approximately $11,400 in programming to add a new field for the exemption of the National Guard members. Senator Geisel is correct. We do anticipate a revenue loss because of the 4,000 members and a loss of the $100 for each of the members every 2 years.
All right. Thank you, Amy, and appreciate your willingness to accommodate things like this we're doing. Any questions for Amy and DMV, Senator Coghill?
No.
All right. Mr. Stephen Burris, can you hear us, sir?
Yes, sir, I can. How are you this morning?
I think we're good. Would you care? Did you? The sheet I have here say you're just here to answer questions. Do you have a statement you'd like to make?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. I do have a statement. I am the president of the Alaska National Guard Enlisted Association, and we are not a part of the National Guard. We represent the National Guard soldiers and airmen here, and that's what we're here for, and that's why I brought this bill forward. I had several members come to me, actually, and ask, could we look at something like this, since Hawaii just put this in a couple years ago. We actually found out there are two more states, Florida and Vermont, that also offer this free license for or license plate for them. In addition to that, there's about 12 to 15 other states who offer a reduced rate for the special plates, as Monica was talking about earlier. The big thing that we're trying to show is when our members are called up to state active duty, they come in and they work, and they work at a base pay, a military base pay rate only. They don't receive BAH. They don't receive a BAS, which is Housing Assistance Allowance.
I'm sorry, Stephen. Most of us don't speak an acronym well.
That's what I was. So the housing, the BAH is called housing, and it's money for housing, and that's what full-time employees get, and the subsistence, the same thing. And they don't get that when they do state active duty to go out and take care of our flooding, our snow removal, like in Valdez last year that we had to put all the folks out. Those are all things they don't get. So that's what we're looking for, is trying to help compensate for that. Yes, it's a great recruiting and retention tool, as the recruiting officers have already said, because it is a benefit that we give our National Guardsmen. One piece of correction that I want to talk to about what Monica was saying with the number of folks that are full-time. The number that she gave with 37,000-some 3,700 or some, that's the total number of National Guardsmen. There's actually only about 1,200 to 1,400 full-timers on duty all the time. The rest are traditional. So the most of them are the part-time weekend warriors, as you called them earlier, sir. So that's what we're looking for, and that's what we're trying to relay across. The understanding was that it's about $100 a year is what we were figuring, because the average registration is $200 for a registration for an individual. So that's what we were thinking. So at 4,000, I think there's 4,300 total positions, but at any given time, we're around 4,000 is all we ever have filled.
Yeah, thank you for that correction. I suspected that those numbers got flipped, but thank you. Any questions for Stephen? All right. Anyone else in the audience wants to testify? Senator Coghill?
Maybe one question. Probably the sponsor can answer it, but my expectation, this has to be active duty at this point, not retired?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Any other questions or discussion?
Oh,
Senator Coghill?
I think I have a conflict here. I have a son-in-law who's a full-time guardsman.
Do you want to excuse yourself?
No, my daughter may very well benefit from this, so just have to be careful here.
Yeah. So I serve, represent the district of the highest active and retired military in the state, and I suspect this will make at least a small difference and a significant symbolic one. The chair will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 141 from this committee, version 28LS1139-U, umbrella, with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing none, the SB 141 passes from committee, and we will adjourn the meeting and take time to sign the document.